Mr. Scott, good morning.
Thank you. May it please the court, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. Essentially, what this case boils down to and what the essential issue is how should the past practice be defined in an unfair labor practice proceeding where the board is alleging that the employer unilaterally changed that past practice. The board would have it that whether the company has ever appointed a joint health and safety representative in the past is the past practice at issue. The company believes that the past practice at issue is whether the position has remained vacant when the unions have been unable to make a joint appointment to that position. We believe that the
company. Well, there was some evidence, wasn't there, that in the past these things hadn't been automatic?
I'm sorry?
Was there not some evidence in the record that the appointment had not necessarily been automatic? And here we're talking about a very short period of time.
There is evidence in the record that was not articulated by the board below, but there is evidence in the record.
What the board refers to it in a summary sentence.
In a very summary sentence. Mm-hmm. And what the actual testimony was from a union official who said back in the 90s there was a 30-day delay
right.
in the union's ability to get together and make that joint appointment.
I'm confused about your argument. Isn't the question here what happens when the unions can't agree who can make the appointment? Isn't that the question?
That is absolutely the question.
Okay, so we look to the record to see what the past practice is with respect to that, correct?
The board needs to prove what the past practice is and then the change is from there.
But isn't that what so the question is the board has to look to see what the past practice was when the unions could not agree. Correct?
That's correct.
And didn't it find that when the unions couldn't agree that the position was left open sometimes until the unions could agree?
But there's no substantial evidence.
What about the testimony of the president?
That's not substantial evidence to support that finding.
It wasn't? He testified that there were, quote, many times the unions couldn't agree, right?
That's correct.
And one time the disagreement went on for a month. And is there any testimony in the record that when the unions couldn't agree, the company made the appointment?
No, because the only testimony in the record of any length of time is that 30 days. And the unions did come to an agreement within that 30 days. That situation is not the situation we have here.
No, but remember, the employer got a letter saying that the unions would give the employer a name in 10 days. So when the employer made the determination, it was clearly within a 30-day period.
No, it wasn't,
no?
Your Honor. I would respectfully disagree with that.
Okay.
I think that what you need to, what the court should do is look at the entirety of the record as it relates to the substantial evidence standard, which I believe the court is duty-bound to do.
Just tell me where I'm wrong on this. There was a February 11th letter. Then there was a response saying
Correct.
We'll have it in 10 days. Then there's the February 18th letter
Correct.
Saying we're making the interim appointment and it will become final by March 1, right?
If no joint appointment is made by the unions by March 1.
Right.
And no joint appointment was put forward by the unions by March 1, by the date of the hearing in this case, and although it's not part of this record to date. The totality of the record is that the historical cooperation between the unions with respect to the appointment of this joint representative has been destroyed over the last several years in the shipyard. The company is in a position where, as they were in February of 2005, where the unions can't get it together to make a joint appointment.
Well, none of this is in the record of this case.
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
It is? What happened?
It is.
The past few years is in the record of the case?
It is through August of 2005, uh-huh. And then the unfair labor practice hearing was in November of 2000 and uh-huh. 5, and the testimony of Mr. Fawcett, I believe, at the hearing was that the union still have not submitted a joint candidate. I believe Mr. Godinez also testified to that regard at the hearing.
And so say again what your description of the past practice is then.
The past practice is the situation that confronted the company was the inability of the unions to make a joint appointment.
All right.
There is no past practice because never before, other than that one 30-day period that Godinez testified to, have the unions been unable to make a joint appointment.
Well, what about the president's testimony that I quoted to you? He says many times.
We submit that that is conclusory testimony.
How there's can that no be detail. Conclusory? He said many times. What's conclusory about that? You didn't, there's no evidence to the contrary in the record.
I don't know that there is, Your Honor, evidence to the contrary, other than I believe that potentially Mr. Heinrichsen may have testified to that point, but I would have to go back and look at the record. I will concede that the conclusory testimony of Godinez stands alone.
Why is it conclusory? What's conclusory about that? He's stating a fact many times.
But
is it conclusory because he doesn't say how many times?
It's conclusory because there's no definition with respect to how long that takes.
Well, was he cross-examined?
He was, Your Honor.
About this issue?
Only to the extent he was asked to give an example, and he gave the 130-day example.
Well, that's one example of many instances, right? I don't understand how a reviewing court can look behind that testimony.
Well,
if you've got a reason, tell us.
There is how
you can do it. It doesn't seem conclusory.
Unless
your concern is that he doesn't say, on 14 occasions or 12 occasions or 3 occasions, he says many.
Your Honor,
you asked for an example, he gave you an example.
We were confronted with a situation where the general counsel, who had the burden of proof before the administrative law judge, stated on the record that there is no past practice with respect to a situation where the unions have been unable to make a joint appointment. I believe that counsel for the company, which was me, at the unfair labor practice hearing, can reasonably rely on that statement from the general counsel.
Even where there's evidence put in the record to the contrary?
I will concede that if I had it all over to do again, I would have never asked Godinez that question because I know what
exactly. Good point.
And that was my error to do that. However, we do have a situation where the general counsel presented his case. He stated that there was no past practice. He closed his case on direct, and then I opened my big mouth on cross-examination. And as soon as as Godinez gave me his conclusory testimony, I didn't probe. I questioned Mr. Godinez.
So are you arguing you were misled by the general counsel?
I'm sorry?
Are you arguing you were misled
by
the general counsel?
I would not say that I was misled by the general counsel.
I
would say that what I was doing was responding to the government's case, which the government has the burden. And as a respondent before the board, I am reacting, or the company is reacting to the government's case as put on by the general counsel.
What about the second issue, waiver of bargaining?
The waiver gets back to there's the past practice in many regards, because the company is saying, you guys can't come up with a joint appointment. What should we do? The union is never accepting that invitation to bargain. What the union is doing is, don't do anything, don't do anything. But the company wants to sit down and bargain.
Well, the February 18th letter says, what is it? Our present intention is to, if you have any questions, call us.
And that is the standard within labor relations. The company has the ability to make a tentative decision subject to discussions with the union. They invite the union.
Do you have any case that's close to, if you have any questions, call us, being an invitation to bargain?
I don't have that here for the court today.
All right. Do you think there's a difference? I mean, to the extent that the waiver has to be clear on the record, and the union's response here is we'll have a name in 10 days, and the board finds that the February 18th letter was a fait accompli, so all the incentive to come together was dissipated.
Well, I don't believe that that finding based on the February 18 letter is supported by the law. A fait accompli, when the board finds a fait accompli, typically it's in a situation where the employer says, this is what we're doing. End of story.
Well, isn't that what happened here?
No.
Well, the union, in its February 14th letter, the union asked for 10 more days to come up with its joint candidate, and the company never responded to that.
And we're still waiting for that joint candidate.
No, that's not my question. My question is, why didn't the company respond to that? Isn't it perfectly logical to think the union would have seen the letters as a fait accompli, given that you didn't answer the, they just requested 10 more days to come up with a joint name?
That they requested 10 more days to come up with a joint appointment,
right,
in circumstances where they had not been able to come up with a joint appointment since January 7, where the unions were obviously fighting among themselves, yeah, with respect to a joint appointment and whether they could come up with one.
Okay.
Can I ask you, I may have missed it, did you put in the record anything, why, any reason why there was such a rush to turn this acting fella into the permanent? I mean, I understand your argument that you needed someone on the committee,
right,
with respect to safety. But was there any specific reason you gave, the company gave, why this man who was acting had to become permanent in 10 days? Or?
No, that's not in the record. And in fact, and as we pointed out in our reply brief and our supplemental excerpts, the company has not taken the position that a joint candidate now will not be put into that place in place of Mr. Johnson, because Mr. Johnson's permanent. That has never been the company's position, and in fact, the company's position has been just the opposite.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Beard.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Heather Beard, and I represent the National Labor Relations Board, which is seeking enforcement of its order in this matter. Never before in 25 years had the company appointed a union health and safety representative. The power was always reserved to the unions and the unions alone in both written and actual practice. And the board here reasonably found that the company abruptly changed course and made its own appointment of a union representative, thereby unlawfully changing a term or condition of employment. Starting with the change in the term or condition of employment. The language of the implemented contract provision, which always was referred to by the company as its policy, was clear and unambiguous, as the board found. Indeed, even the company strictly construed this language when it would not allow an interim or alternative representative to be appointed earlier than the instant dispute. It's also clear that the past practice in this matter was that the company had never, under any circumstances, appointed a union representative for the health and safety position. The unions did so, and even in the many times when they could not agree, the company did not ever appoint anyone. Now, the company's main defense to this is really just an attempt to convert the unremarkable contingency of the unions not immediately being able to make a decision as to who the representative would be into some sort of brand new circumstance that would obliterate the clear history of the company's never appointing the union representatives. And the board's finding to the contrary is amply supported by the law and the facts, given the policy that the company was never appointing the union reps, given the fact that when there were many times that the unions could not make an appointment on their own or agree right away, the company in that context never made the appointment. And based upon that evidence, which is in the record, the board found that, the board reasonably found that the company changed the terms and conditions of employment that these employees had been used to for over 25 years. Now, the first point that my opposing counsel made I'd like to address is this issue of how the petition has been now, would have been open indefinitely if the company did not act. That argument, in terms of it appearing to be some sort of exigent circumstance argument, was never raised before the board, and there was no evidence ever put in the record as to that. And indeed, the circumstances that we were confronted with are circumstances that were at the middle of February, early March 2005, when the company decided to immediately put in Mr. Johnson and to say that he would become permanent without any joint appointment from the unions. And that took place in this 30-day period from the time Mr. Hernandez on February 4th was to retire to March 1st when Mr. Johnson was made permanent by the company. What happened after that date is not relevant to the charge that was filed after Mr. Johnson was put in this position. At that time, the company usurped the right of the unions to pick the joint appointment, and that is the time that is relevant and why the board found that the union did not waive its right to bargain. Whatever happened in August, September, later in 2005, not relevant to the facts that are before this court. Now, with regard to the fait accompli finding of the board, as I think this court recognizes, the company has the burden of establishing that the union waived its right to bargain, and that needs to be clear and unmistakable by the union. And in this case, there's no evidence that the union clearly and unmistakably waived its right to bargain. Indeed, the chronology of events is that the union consistently said, we do not believe you have the right to...
What about the sentence in the two letters that says, if you have any questions or wish to discuss this further, company is willing to meet and talk about it.
Right. Well, in order for that letter not to have been a fait accompli with those words, mm-hmm. I think that the letter would have had to at least communicate that the company would not just talk with the unions, but actually discuss a proposal to leave that position vacant until the unions reached agreement. And that's
did the ALJ say that?
What the ALJ said was, in essence, that language in the context indicated that.
Did he say anything about that language at all?
I think it's JA 585, Your Honor, where uh-huh. the ALJ makes his finding where he says the union was presented with a fait accompli when respondent announced it was appointing an interim union health and safety representative and would make the appointment permanent on March 1st, 2005 if the unions did not come up with a joint candidate. That is a reference to the language in the February 18th letter.
Right, but it's not a reference to the sentence giving the union an opportunity to discuss it. I mean, he didn't say anything about that.
The exact language in the letter where it says that the company has, we will discuss it with you, is not specifically in,
right.
or explicitly, rather, in the decision.
Right, so, and you say in your brief that's just boilerplate, right?
Correct. Indeed.
You see what I'm getting at? We have to review the decision of the ALJ. So how do you justify this court affirming his fait accompli determination given that he did not mention that sentence?
Sure. I think that the fait accompli finding that the uh-huh. ALJ makes does not need to explicitly state the sentence that you and I were just discussing when uh-huh. it mentions the actual letter itself. The letter itself does encompass and include uh-huh. that sentence. And when the company in their brief responded to the fait accompli finding, and the company says, no, let's point to this language, I think it was perfectly appropriate for the board to respond by noting the letter itself has language in there that does not obviate the fait accompli finding. And indeed, the post hoc cases that are cited throughout the reply brief by the company are all cases which are nowhere near the circumstances or the kinds of decision making that was done in those cases were nowhere near the kind of reasoned decision making that was done in the instant case. I believe some of the language used in those cases was was when the decision is inscrutable or the antithesis of our, the antithesis of reasoned decision-making. And I would submit, the board would submit, that this language in the ALJ decision specifically referencing this letter and referring to it as a fait accompli with the cases cited, sufficient for this court to uphold the board's finding. Again, given that the burden is on the company to show that there is a waiver, and that would uphold the, there's enough here to uphold the board's finding that this was a fait accompli and thus the union did not waive any of its rights. If there are...
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Does Mr. Scott have any time? All right, why don't you take a minute?
I'm sorry.
Why don't you take a minute if you want it?
Thank you. I would like to mention one thing, and it does relate to the post hoc issue here. One thing that was raised below repeatedly was that the change at issue here, that is placing someone into the vacant position, did not have a substantial and material effect on the terms and conditions of employment of the unit employees. And in fact, it actually promoted the stability of their terms and conditions of employment by having a full complement of safety representatives. This issue was never treated by the ALJ. It was never treated by the board. It was treated in board counsel's answering brief before this court. We would submit that that's a little too late. There simply is no evidence that would support a determination that the change at issue here has had a frustrated the expectations of the employees. In fact, it has promoted it, and we would ask that the court take a look at its Acme Dye decision in that regard. Thank you.
All right, thank you.